This is an interview with George Branger, who has been a member of the Outrigger Canoe Club since 1935. This interview is being conducted on August 8, 1984, at the home of Ken Pratt, 4817 Aukai Avenue. The interviewer is Ken Pratt, representing the Outrigger Canoe Club Oral History Committee. George, before we get into your early days at the Outrigger Canoe Club, could you tell us something about yourself?
Well, I was born in France, came to California near San Jose, where my father ran an alcohol distillery for this group in San Francisco. He was part owner. And he made a deal with A and B, Alexander and Baldwin, for molasses. We used to have storage tanks in Hilo. The molasses went into Crockett. And on part of it, the molasses and dry alfalfa were made in the cattle field. The balance went down to the distillery that is near San Jose and was distilled in 190 proof alcohol.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Then, later, they made uncut, uncolored whiskey for the two-bit shots.
Oh, yeah.
In the old days. And we used to have 30 coopers there making 50-gallon charred barrels all day long, 8 hours a day. Then it was put in the charred barrels and eventually sent to the distributor. What they did with it, we didn't know and didn't particularly care.
You know? I see.
Then the First War came along, and an engineer said to my father, you know, the residue from the distillation we used to put in the dump in the Alviso Creek that eventually landed in San Francisco Bay, that we make potash out of it. So we started making potash with really like finding gold, you know. Then, during the war, we figured out, my father figured out he could make acetone out of the potash.
Yeah.
And we were furnishing acetone to the DuPonts from that period on, all till the war ended.
For goodness sake. Now, did you get into the war yourself at all?
No, I was too young for the first one and too old for the second one.
I see. Now, you had to put in duty in France, though, is that right?
Oh, yes. My family, my father retired and took the whole family back to France. And then he bought the newspaper in a small town of Niort, where we come from, because his friend's son was supposed to run it after the war. But the boy had lost both arms and both legs, so he was a basket case.
Oh, yeah.
So my father bought the paper and had my godfather run it. And they talked him into running for the Senate. He said, this is ridiculous. I've been gone from the country for 15 years. In those old days, that's just like being a foreigner. Well, anyway, he ran and was elected.
That's interesting.
And eventually ended up is on the Disarmament Commission with Maginot. But being a French citizen, I had to do 2 years military service. I was getting 50 centimes a day, which is a little less than 10 cents.
You couldn't go out in the town on that stuff.
No.
But when did you get back to the United States? What year?
Well, I don't know if you want all that story and everything.
Well, not too long. We got to get that back to the Outrigger
Well,
Club.
I got back in 1923, the end of 23, the beginning of 24, via Panama, where I went broke. And I worked for 4 months as a truck driver, six days upriver in Colombia. Believe me, in those days, that was really rough. So that's when I got back to California.
Uh-huh.
They made one little picture in Burlingame, and I worked in it. And I said, well, I want to really get in pictures, so I went to Hollywood. As a matter of fact, I started at the same time John Wayne, Gary Cooper, and Clark Gable.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Gary Cooper used to see all the studios, apart from Universal in those days, were in Hollywood. And the Fox was on the corner of Sunset and Western. And I remember Gary Cooper standing out in front with the boots, the jeans, the kerchief, and the hat. And the second assistant director would come out and say, hey, you, $3 and lunch. He'd say, yep. That was a dead tired box lunch, two sandwiches and an apple, and $3. In those days, Clark Gable, I lived at the Village Inn, was about four blocks beyond going into Hollywood from Fox. Then two blocks beyond that was Warner Brothers. Clark Gable, which wasn't his name then, lived in a garage apartment behind the little hotel I was in. Oh, I was a big shot. I was paying $10 a week for a room and bath. Gable was working in Warner Brothers as a laborer, digging post holes. They were putting new fencing around the Warner Brothers studio there. Wayne never had a decent suit of clothes because he drank everything he made. So they had to put him in a mob scene or a costume.
Huh. Well, eventually he became a star. Was this a few years
later?
Oh, sure.
They all became stars.
Uh-huh.
I didn't. I guess I was a little too independent.
Uh-huh. But you were in a good many movies.
Oh, sure. I never did anything big. I did extra work. I did small parts. I did small scenes here and there. Like, for instance, John Ford, the old motion picture producer, was a good friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
I used to play hearts practically every Saturday night at his house with John Wayne, his wife, Mary Ford, Wingate Smith, his brother-in-law. And any time he had a scene where he wanted a Frenchman, a hotel manager in Gold Star Mothers, I did a hotel manager in that.
I'll be darned.
And just a couple of shots.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted a French soldier in the trenches. Well, I was elected.
And you could speak French.
Yeah,
fluently,
but they were silent pictures. You know, they didn't make a damn bit of difference.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But he wanted the guy that was a Frenchman. You know.
Now, weren't you in a movie with Duke Kahanamoku, Summer Love?
Oh, that goes way back to 1927 on the Rough Riders. And we worked. Duke wasn't with us all the time in Texas, but we were in San Antonio in that picture for about 2 months.
Uh-huh.
And we came back to Hollywood, and there was a scene on a beach. See, one day we were Cubans fighting the Americans, and the next day we were Americans fighting the Cubans. So that's all the 2 months in Texas. It was seen on the beach. Well, the minute I heard that, I put a pair of swim trunks under my uniform. And I saw the Duke out there body surfing. And I said, brother, I will learn how to do that. So I stripped down to my swim trunks, and I went over and said, hey, brother, show me. So he showed me how to body surf.
Isn't that great?
And we became...
This is in Malibu, huh?
Yeah, Malibu, outside of Malibu, a little beach. Not right in town, a little beach outside of town where there'd be no people. So we became good friends. Uh-huh. And eventually I came over here the first time in 1928, and I was down on the beach by the exit for the bathers for the Royal Hawaiian, and Elmer Lee used to have a little shack.
Sure,
there.
I remember that.
He used to sell different things. And Duke was there, and he had Chick Daniels with him, and Tough Bill, Curly, I don't know, several of the old-timers. Hey, he said to me, Kyoki, hey, how are you? So I went over and shook hands with him, and he introduced me to all the Beach Boys, so I had a front door entrance to the beach gang.
Great. The Huinala bunch, huh?
Huh?
That was the Huinala bunch.
No, those were the Beach Boys.
Oh,
the Huinala, yeah.
Huinala Beach
Boys. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, one of them said, I had a little dump down on Upper Lower Cleghorn I was paying all of $25 a month for. And I said, what do you change? One of the boys said, what do you change? Okay. I said, home. I know. He said, come in, use our Uinalum. They had, that's where they kept the boards, no lockers, they were stacked. So when you went in to look for your board, somebody else that was in first break with it.
Oh.
You had to wait till they came in.
Far away, huh?
Yeah. But so I used their locker room, showers and everything, and it was Nudie Miller ran the Uinalum.
Sure, he was top man there for years.
And it was interesting to meet that whole gang. They accepted me. When they needed an extra man besides the second captain that they didn't have to pay, I would always volunteer. I wanted to work out and, get some exercise. So I was the third paddle when they had a big load of tourists that couldn't pull their own weight.
Uh-huh.
Then we'd all go fishing. I'd go fishing with them. And it got to be sort of a thing that went on for years. And even after I went into the business, the chick or somebody, hey, come here, we got some fish for you. So an envelope, blue, brown manila envelope, with a few fish, might have been octopus, but I had Japanese cooked, so it would be harder to cook it.
Uh-huh.
So it was, to me, I'll never forget, the first day, second day I was on the beach. Do you remember those hau trees before you got to the Moana and the benches there?
Oh, yes, all yes. Right.
I walked in there and put my elbows on the back of those benches. I watched the surf, the canoe, this. I said, this is it. I said,
you're not going back to the mainland.
No, no, no way, no way.
Well, I think that was a smart decision you made at that time.
Huh?
Yeah, it was a smart decision to decide to stay in Hawaii.
Oh, sure.
I don't think there's a better place in the world.
Oh, Christ, no. I've been all over the world, all the West Indies, all the islands in the Pacific, islands in the Indian Ocean, Seychelles, Mauritius, and all on and on. Climatically, we've got it licked, and as far as a place to live, this is it.
Well, now, so your first introduction to Waikiki Beach was at the Huinalo site. When did you join the Outrigger Canoe Club?
Well, you see, I went away, then I came back.
I see.
I came back in 1935. I had arranged, I got a lease on a building in the Dillingham building, below Chez Pierre's restaurant there, going Mackay. And I opened a men's shop there with a partner. Miller, Neil Miller, who claimed he had a lot of experience. Then I find out later he'd worked for 2 weeks Christmas vacations for a men's store in Los Angeles.
A biggie.
I'd never run a store, but I always felt I knew clothes. And I went on the buying. He said, oh, you're doing all right, you buy. So I bought the whole thing. I didn't even know how to mark those things at first.
What was the store called?
Miller Brangine.
I see.
I put his name first because mine is too hard to pronounce. It probably, if I, some people address me as Brazier. So, we started that 1935, and not knowing any better, I opened the store 2 weeks before Christmas instead of 2 months. But I'd brought over lines that they'd never seen any bleached denim before. They hadn't seen this, they hadn't seen that. I had to cut some tail rings. I knew how to measure because I had all my clothes custom made. And we'd select the material, we'd send it to the mainland, and 3 weeks later you had your suit. I knew about the alteration, shorten the back a little bit, this and that. Yeah. And I don't want to seem braggadocious, but 3 days after Christmas, first year, I was calling the mainland for more merchandise.
Oh, it was an immediate success.
It was. And then the following year, I ordered twice as much merchandise. But that was the year that we had the 6 month shipping strike, and I got my merchandise the following March after Christmas.
Uh-huh.
So, nothing to do, I had to get something in there. So I bought batiks at East India store, the Japanese stores. I bought Japanese prints, and I found little dressmakers. In the meantime, Nat Norfleet Sr. had come over, and he was helping me, because Miller had gone back to the bailiff, and he was helping me sell window dress and sell in the store. And we had shirts made, I had swim trunks made, on and on and on. And put them in the store, and they all sold. So that's when Walter Flanders, my name has come back, man, Walter Flanders, and Walter Mack wanted to buy my shop. I'd taken Neil out of it, Neil Miller, so I was the sole owner. I'd gotten him on a boat with a cashier's check so he could repay his mother, but otherwise... They wanted to buy the store, so I sold it to them.
Uh-huh.
And I started... I first called it Branfleet, the factory for making sportswear. Half my name, half Norfleet's name. Then after we got well established all over the country, even London, Harrods of London, Gallery Lafayette in Paris, David Jones in Australia, all the Bullock stores, I talked to them, and I said, because we use Kahala as our label in the shirts.
Uh-huh.
I said, don't you think it would be better to change the name of Kahala Sportswear? They said, yes, there's no confusion that way, which we changed a few years later. And as I say, I don't want to sound, it didn't happen overnight, don't worry. But we had them all, the big ones.
Yeah. Now, it's still in the 30s, or are you talking about the 40s by now?
Oh, we were up into the 40s.
In the 40s at that time, yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, to give you an order, to give you an idea, B. Altman, they're buying for four big stores back east. Their opening order was $185,000 the year that I left the company.
Hmm.
You know, look. Anyway, there's things that, to me, is so contrary. Neiman Marcus Beyer came in. I usually let Norfleet sell because you're a lot more patient than I am. I'm inclined to be impatient with people when they're too stupid. You know? So I was kibitzing. In other words, I was sitting by to see what was happening. Well, there was a print that I designed in Japan. We had a lot of stuff, our prints done in Japan. And we also use California handprints at Hermosa Beach. They were all screen-printed textiles. This way we knew we had them exclusively.
Uh-huh.
And this buyer looked at that little shirt maker dress, and she said, I think that print is terrific. I like that dress. So I'd done sort of monotone, nothing loud, just subdued, which I'm inclined to like myself. I said, but she said, you know, Neiman Marcus won't let us sell the cotton dress for less than $55. And this was, you know, quite a few years back. I said, so? Oh, he said, Neiman won't let us take a long markup. So I said to her, that's no problem. I'll double the price. She said, fine, I'll take
$300. Ah! Nice deal for you.
We were making 40% already. But...
Now, back, you say you got here in 35. That's about the time that Bill Mulahy was putting together his beach services, wasn't it? Do you remember anything about that?
No, I don't. Oh, I remember hearing about it vaguely, but I don't really know.
Actually, in the early 30s, Toots Minville,
yeah, you
know, had talked to the board and said that he could put together a beach service deal that would be a gold mine.
Downstairs, there, under the new Artery Club.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, and I remember that now, yes.
But then he went to Molokai for about 3 years. In the meanwhile, Bill Mullahy came in and they turned to Bill to set that thing up.
I'm the one that put the garments in that little office.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm down in Kahawa Sportsman.
And the club made good money on it.
Oh, sure. But it was I had to get a hold of Val, who did the building, Ossipoff, to put some shelving in there, because when Sally Hale was running it, all the garments were in a room up by the main office as you walked in.
Uh-huh.
So if he happened to bring the wrong color and wrong size for a gal that wanted a two-piece suit, he'd have to go all the way back and forth. So I got Ossipoff to work out some deal to put a little miniature storeroom where the bulk was up the other end, but we had a display so we could show several things at one time.
Oh, yeah.
We had put in at the beginning was the Duke Kahanamoku stuff. You remember the coat of arms?
Yes.
And that heavy material?
Sure.
Two-piece suits
for
women and swim trunks for men and shirts. That's all. We didn't have enough room when they got to put all our other merchandise.
Yeah. Talking about garments, I guess the Dache law was passed before you got to the islands. I think it was the Dache. Remember the Dache law on swimming suits, where you couldn't wear a swimming suit, abbreviated swimming suit on the.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Remember that?
Well, I belonged to the old ladies' club when the Outrigger moved up here.
Oh, you the Ulanio Swimming Club?
Yeah.
Yes.
You couldn't walk around unless you had an undershirt on with your swim trunk. You know?
I'd forgotten that.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
We'd get out on the beach and take it off, and the minute we'd walk back into the club, we'd put it on again.
Now, you were a member of the Ulanio Swimming Club for a good many years, too, weren't you?
Not too long. I joined when we moved up here.
That late? I thought you had joined long before that.
I know. I used to go in there. In fact, they had gotten the impression that they were going to be kicked out when the Royal was putting in, a snack bar in there.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of the manager of the Royal's name at that time. Come back. Nice guy that went to work for... later, ran a bunch of hotels for one of the Rockefeller. I went in and talked to him, and I said, look, this would be very bad public relations if you kick these people here, these old-timers here, out of here, just to put in a snack bar. I said, isn't there some way that we could share with you? He said, yeah, George, sure. I won't kick them out. I'll just use part of it and use the chairs and tables so people can sit down and eat and have a counter where they make the sandwiches. So I went back to the gal. I said, you don't have to move.
Isn't that great?
Just share.
Uh-huh.
I said, really? I said, yeah, you're all set. From the head man's mouth. And then, do you remember there was the... remember that dance studio that was on the Royal Wine Grounds?
Dan Wallace.
Yeah.
Yes, sure.
I had a two-story garage shack. And I'd worked on something that if the old gals had to move out of there, I talked to Midkiff, who was a trustee of the...
Frank Midkiff.
Yeah, the Bishop of State.
Yeah, right.
I talked to him, a couple other people. And I got Frank Slavsky to draw some plans, which he was doing gratis for the club because he was using the club, just his cost, you know, that we could put in the old ladies' club there, in that two-story grass shack.
Would have been a natural.
Sure.
Walk a few more feet, but what the heck?
But a little even a room there with a bar kitchen for a guy to take care of it, to live there. We would not use the Royal Hawaiian chairs and towels. We'd just use the beach. This is fine. But the gals wouldn't go for it. All the work to be done, it was $1,000 a month.
Dirt cheap.
The Royal wanted it. But the thing that killed the deal was that It's about $60,000 in expenses to put in the club.
Oh, I see. I see. They had a pretty good portfolio of investments.
Sure, so. But they didn't want to go for that amount. And they were talking at moving out towards Lae.
Yeah.
I said, now, wait a minute. Lae, I mean, how many people do you think are going to go all the way out of Lae to get a swim after work? That's ridiculous. It has to be closer in, accessible. Then I was working on another thing. Can't think of the name of that. One of the old gals had a club down there, Waikiki, right next to DeRussy.
Oh, that was the Waikiki Swimming Club.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember. That was actually, I think, the YWCA.
That's right, right,
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I was trying to work out a deal for them there, you know, for them. It would be that close.
They had a nice little place there.
Yes, but you had, what, 8 parking stalls.
Ah, yes.
And they're all chained off. So you come in, you double park, you go in and get the key to your stall and put your car in, and then when you take your car out, you have to lock it up again and take the key back to the office. You know, for 8 stalls. There's no way we could do it.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, grasping at anything that might work to keep them close in.
Uh-huh.
But we had it for I don't know how long with the Royal, I think a couple of years or something like that. And I was able to fix up some of the dressing rooms. And
I think they finally lost the lease around 68.
Something like that, I
right
can't remember.
That time, yeah. And some of them are very happy with the home out there. Like, yeah. I went out and looked at it. It's not a bad place. And if you don't have any other place to go to, it's great.
You took the words right out of my mouth. If you don't have any other place to go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were very fortunate.
Yeah.
At the Outrigger Canoe Club, that some of the board and other people were farsighted enough to latch onto that Elks Club property. Do you know any of the background on that purchase? Or purchase
no.
or lease?
Sam, what's his name?
Poipoi?
No, not Sam Poipoi. Hawaiian. Big guy. Part of one. He was on the board of directors or president or something at that time. Of course, I think the place that we missed and missed badly. You remember Chris's Holmes house there?
Oh, that would have been a great thing.
We offered 2 acres, the main house, and the 2 side things that were used for servants' quarters and garages in the old. It could have been converted for juniors on each side. He had a kitchen that was big enough to handle a hotel.
Yeah, I've been in that. Oh, yeah. You know, before they converted to Queen Serve.
Yeah.
No, wait a minute. What was the name of that, the restaurant there? Spence Weaver put in a restaurant there.
Yeah. Spence Weaver took over. But we were offered that. Ena McKinney. You remember Ena McKinney?
Ena was an old buddy of mine. I know Ena
well.
Yeah, well,
he and his group didn't know what to do with it. And they offered it to us for $225,000
pieces. Wow. I have never heard that.
Oh, well.
Is that right? Now, when would that have been?
Oh, I don't know.
66, 67, maybe?
Something like that.
Because they were in a quandary there.
Yeah.
Remember, there were some developers that said they could continue there if such and such an arrangement was made, but that fell
2 1/4 a square foot and almost 2 acres.
Isn't that amazing?
$250,000.
But they said...
This is not on tape, is it?
Yes, sure, it's all on
tape.
Well,
I don't want to malign anybody, so...
All right, let's... George, you've been a tremendous help to the club as an active member of the Building and Grounds Committee. As a member of this committee for many years, could you give us some idea of the many changes that took place at the new club? You got in there shortly after the club moved over to the new location, didn't you?
I don't exactly remember the date. I changed a lot of the planting. Moved some that was in the wrong place and should have been another. I shifted them around. I added. But Now what we're trying to stop is the kids from putting their salty surfboards on all the plants there.
Oh, is that right? They're killing them, huh?
Oh, they've been doing it for years. I've been trying to stop it since 81, but nobody wants in.
I know when they first moved in there, there was some talk about cutting down some of the old ironwoods.
The what?
The old ironwood trees, they were going to cut them down, and fortunately...
Across, on our frontage.
Yeah, on the frontage there.
Yeah, but I don't think they'd let us, would
they? Well...
That's not ours. That's
oh, that was on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Oh, I
see. On the other side of the sidewalk.
Uh-huh. So that wouldn't have been, you couldn't have done that anyway. No, I remember there's some talk that they...
I know, a city and county guy came to me. He said, you see, the trees here are uprooting all the sidewalk. You have to do all the sidewalk over. Well, I said, we will. I said, geez, I'm going to have to cut a hell of a lot of root off of those trees. He says, forget about that.